This is Wisconsin Today. Sometimes it's nice to take a trip into nature and step away from the hustle and bustle of daily routines.
But before going on that hike, don't forget to put on the L.L. Bean boots, a Patagonia jacket, a hat and gloves from REI.
Grab a Hydro Flask water bottle, strap on an Eddie Bauer backpack, and suddenly you're outfitted in hundreds of dollars of gear just to get away from it all.
Brands like these market the great outdoors to us and our wallets. And our next guest wrote a book exploring how the industry has commercialized our experiences with nature.
Rachel S. Gross is an assistant professor of history at University of Colorado, Denver, and a graduate of UW-Madison. Her book is called Shopping All the Way to the Woods, How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America. Rachel, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So you boil it down for us that for every outdoor excursion, that we Americans, we go shopping first. Why is the stuff that we take outdoors so defining of who we are?
Well, I don't think it had to be, but part of what this book does is trace how people started to attach a big part of their identity, their sense of self, to the goods that they acquired on their way to the woods. And in the late 19th century, at the outset of the outdoor recreation industry, guidebooks, practitioners started to teach these lessons about how to acquire the right things in order to get back to the woods the right way. And those lessons are still with us in many ways today.
There were even like hiking with a capital H and things you really need to survive outdoors. You know, one of the early clothing symbols you discuss in the book is buckskin. Can you tell us the story behind buckskin and this Wisconsin man, Ruel Garnish Baldwin, taking his deer hide to a Bad River Chippewa woman to make a jacket?
Yeah, absolutely. So when this young man hunted a deer, he was able to take the hide and have a Native American woman who had the expertise transform it into a fringed buckskin jacket. And that jacket today and the records around it are a part of the Wisconsin Historical Society's collections, which is how I came to know about it. And this is important because it's emblematic of early outdoor recreation culture. Guidebooks of the late 19th century told readers, if you want to get back to nature the right way, you must make all of your gear yourself. This was a philosophy known as woodcraft. It imagined kind of using nature as a storehouse rather than bringing goods with you that you purchased from a shop. You must make them yourselves. And young white men like Baldwin, who were eager to be a part of this activity, didn't necessarily have the skills to back up that kind of claim. And so they relied on the labor and expertise of local Native women in order to transform the hides that they had gathered into the jackets that they so coveted. And this is important because it represents the fact that the styles of the late 19th century outdoors kind of have a much longer history, and also that the ambitions or aspirations that outdoor recreationists expressed about making everything themselves wasn't necessarily backed up by their actual practices.
And you're right how that there was no equivalent to the buckskin suit for women. How did women fit into this story of outdoor recreation?
Yeah, the research uncovers the fact that women have been longtime participants in the outdoor world, both as practitioners, so lovers of the outdoors who go hiking, camping, and hunting, but also as members of the outdoor recreation industry themselves. So they're gear makers as well as gear buyers and lovers. And this story looks at the women who owned companies and helped design high-end sleeping bags in the middle of the 20th century, as well as the women who tried to navigate their performance of gender, or especially femininity, alongside their need for highly functional performance wear for the activities that they were pursuing.
And it's interesting how even the businesses don't really know how to portray women in their marketing and in their catalogs and where they fit into the picture of outdoor recreation. Why was there so much tension around that when women loved the outdoors just as much as men?
Well, there's a good advertisement. Maybe this is the one you're thinking of. It ran in Vogue in the early 20th century, and it advertised the outdoor woman as outfitted by Abercrombie & Fitch. Companies like Abercrombie & Fitch, which outfitted outdoor recreationists in the early 20th century, struggled with the notion of having women appear kind of in appropriate feminine norms and styles while still being able to access their activities. And this has to do with the masculinist nature of outdoor recreation culture, a legacy that is also still with us today. I think companies and the consumers that purchased from them were navigating this idea that the outdoors was a space for men to prove themselves and their power, virility, and strength. And women finding a place within that culture was a challenge. And that's partly reflected in the attitudes about clothing, style, and equipment.
And then within that manhood, you look at the impact of World War II. How does military surplus start to find its way into the outdoor goods industry?
Well, that is a fun story that I was so surprised to uncover. It turns out that the U.S. military, specifically the Quartermaster Corps, recruited many outdoor industry professionals, think folks like Leon Leonwood Bean, L.L. Bean, or Eddie Bauer, to work with them as consultants to advise on how to equip soldiers for extreme cold weather fighting. These outdoor industry professionals both advised, but also took back with them many of the lessons of scientific testing and layering from the U.S. military to their companies in the decades that followed World War II. So there's a wartime back and forth with the industry and the military, and then the story of the post-war period is really one of military surplus. There's a great Wisconsin example of this story. Fontana, the Madison Outdoor Company, the retail store, got its start in the late 1940s as a military surplus store. It later transformed into a focus exclusively on outdoor recreation and outdoor clothing. But like so many stores all over the country, it was this flood of military surplus in the immediate post-World War II period that led to the creation of outdoor stores that were affordable and accessible to millions of Americans for the first time.
We're talking with University of Colorado Denver history professor Rachel Gross. Her new book is called Shopping All the Way to the Woods, How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America. Let's turn our focus to Gore-Tex, the waterproof, breathable material used so widely in outdoor clothing. And you talk about in the 90s, Gore-Tex really moving into people's everyday wear. And the hit TV show Seinfeld picks up on the trend with this punchline about George wearing a new Gore-Tex jacket that is super puffer and bulky, barely fitting through the doorway of Jerry's apartment. Let's listen.
When did you get that?
This week. My father got a deal from a friend of his. It's Gore-Tex. You know about Gore-Tex?
You like saying Gore-Tex, don't you?
Honey, you can't even turn around in that thing.
Hey, look at this.
Hey, George, can you feel us?
I love that moment. What drove the mainstream enthusiasm for Gore-Tex?
Well, I actually think its high-end kind of performance orientation was a big part of the attraction for ordinary consumers who are not planning to climb up Everest or do something the equivalent. Gore-Tex, which was initially somewhat of a failure, the first generation of the breathable synthetic material didn't work that well. In its later generations, it had really kind of great technical capabilities, a very high price point, and it was advertised as being basically effective for high-end performance. And that made it attractive to people who weren't planning on climbing up mountains, but rather walking among them or perhaps just walking their dogs in a suburban area. The idea that they were going to have something highly functional with great brand recognition is a big part of the Gore-Tex appeal.
And there's so much push here from the chemical companies who had created, the chemistry in Gore-Tex. And now with so many industries trying to remove PFAS from their products, the forever chemicals linked to cancers, PFAS were in Gore-Tex shells. How has the outdoor industry reckoned with that?
Well, I think the reckoning is not new, as any historian might say. There's a much longer history to outdoor industry professionals thinking through the products that they're selling and the impact they have on the beloved places they like to access, the wild nature. So way back in the 1970s, the outdoor industry was questioning kind of their role in contributing to pollution and kind of other kinds of waste in wild places. I would say that the current outdoor industry's concern for their impact on the environment and human health is far more wide-ranging than it was 50 years ago. And so this concern about chemicals like PFAS getting into waterways, into people's bloodstreams, is a much deeper one that reflects our broader understanding of the impacts of petrochemicals in everyday life. I don't think that the solutions kind of are wholly in kind of new technological innovations, although you might see really cool things like, say, skis made out of algae or something like that, right? You know, there's innovations to be had when it comes to new technologies and new materials that aren't plastics-based. However, another big part of the industry's response to this question that you're pointing toward is ways of addressing the culture of consumption itself. So recognizing that it might be impossible to produce things that don't have a negative impact on the earth or on human health, and therefore kind of addressing this issue of buying more all the time, right? Always going shopping on the way to the woods is the next place that the industry is going to turn its attention.
So does being more aware of how the outdoor industry markets to us and changes the way we experience the outdoors, how does our approach change when we now think about, you know, how we're being sold a product to be used outdoors?
Well, listeners should be aware that this book is not trying to excoriate the outdoor industry. And the takeaway isn't don't buy gear. I myself am an outdoor lover and a gearhead. And I recognize that, of course, many items are necessary for comfort or safety when it comes to participating in outdoor activities. Instead, I think this research pushes us to consider more deeply how we have come to accept that purchases are tied up with our identity. And we could decouple that somewhat, recognizing, in other words, that kind of buying one pair of socks in green versus brown doesn't necessarily have to define who I am as an outdoors person or my level of expertise, which is something that I believed when I was a much younger kind of aspiring outdoors person. I believe that understanding these deeper histories can lead us to become more critical consumers, even if that doesn't have an immediate impact on what I'm including on my packing list. I think that that level of reflection has a broader benefit.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rachel S. Gross is an assistant professor of history at the University of Colorado, Denver. Her new book is called Shopping All the Way to the Woods.